Welcome to Your Health. I'm Rebecca Davis. Today we'll hear more about mental health on college campuses, the new H1N1 swine flu vaccine, why is there such a shortage? And in this high-tech world, isn't there a better way to make vaccines than the old-fashioned chicken egg? But first, I guess we all know that your age has a lot to do with how much you pay for health insurance premiums. The older you are, the more expensive you become, and the more your insurance costs. But Congress is trying to figure out how much more. They'd like to come up with national standards, but there's a lot of disagreement over what those standards should be. To make things more complicated, each state has a different rule for how insurance companies can use age to set premiums. From member station KQED, Sarah Varney explains the challenges.
Okay, so imagine you're at a pool party. It's a mix of people in the neighborhood, some older folks, some middle-aged, new parents with screaming babies, new college grads. They're all standing around in their bathing suits, itsy-bitsy and the not-so-itsy-bitsies. Now, for health insurance to work best, all of those people need to get in the pool. Well, of course, the older folks jump in first. They've got more health problems and really need the insurance than the middle-aged people. And parents with young kids jump on it. But the younger ones, the ones who are rocking the itsy-bitsy bikinis and board shorts, how do you get them to jump in? Especially when the water looks really cold. That is exactly the problem Congress is trying to figure out.
There's no magic involved in how you set premiums.
Larry Levitt is vice president of the Kaiser Family Foundation. He says you need the 20-somethings in the pool because they help balance out the cost of insuring older people who use more medical care.
You're still going to have to raise enough money for premiums to pay for the health care services that people use.
And just how do you do that? Should younger people pay less and older people pay more? Or should we share the cost since we'll all be old someday? The bill passed by the Senate Finance Committee would allow insurers to charge older adults four times the amount it charges younger people. The House bill and the Senate Health Committee bill make a different choice. They would limit what insurers can charge older adults to two times the amount. The insurance industry strongly prefers the higher 4-to-1 multiple. Elisa Fox, senior vice president of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association, says the fear is if you make insurance too expensive for younger adults, they just won't buy it.
It's very important to have significant discounts for younger people so they purchase insurance.
But the insurance industry is leaving out a critical element, says Linda Blumberg, a researcher at the Urban Institute. She says the current health reform bills all provide subsidies for lower-income Americans and...
The young adults tend to be lower income, so they really are buffered a great deal from the full impact.
Blumberg is more worried about middle-income older Americans, the 55 to 64-year-olds. After all, discounts for younger people mean surcharges for older ones, and those older adults are less likely to qualify for a government subsidy.
More than half of individuals in that 55 to 64 age group with incomes between 400 and 500% of the federal poverty level would have household health care financing burdens of over 20%.
Should I translate that? What she's saying is my mom, before she retired, would have ended up spending 20% of her income to buy health insurance. And because she earned too much to qualify for a government subsidy, she would be, how would she say this, up a creek. Elisa Fox at the Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation says to handle that problem, Congress should give special subsidies to older people with middle incomes. But Congress is already apoplectic about the cost of health reform and, according to several sources, has little appetite for giving subsidies to people who make a pretty good living, around $54,000 a year. Can we go back to the pool for a moment? There are other ways of getting those young people in the pool.
You can push them!
That's right, you can push them by making the penalties for going uninsured more expensive than a basic plan. The current bills do include penalties, but many economists and the insurance industry claim they're not high enough to be effective. You can also require employers provide health insurance, since the majority of uninsured young people are working. The bills differ on how strongly they do this. However Congress decides the issue, they could look to other countries that have universal health care and a private insurance industry. None of them, including Germany and the Netherlands, use age or any other personal characteristic to set premiums. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Varney.
So you've probably heard by now, there's a shortage of the H1N1 swine flu vaccine. Richard Knox tells us why and how that affects government plans to protect Americans against the new flu.
To get an idea of the shortage, let's look at Los Angeles. It wasn't until this weekend that they could hold swine flu vaccine clinics. L.A. County Health Commissioner Jonathan Fielding opened the first two himself.
I'm standing outside one of our vaccine clinics, which is being held in Encino, a part of Los Angeles.
He says demand was very high. Most of the people had to wait between 1 and 3 hours, and Fielding didn't see many people dropping out of the lines leading into the clinics.
We were planning to have more before this, in fact, but we had to cancel them because of the lack of vaccine.
All over the country, in cities and rural counties, there's a big gap between supply and demand.
The vaccine situation is quite frustrating. You know, the numbers that we were asked to anticipate and plan with have turned out to be gross overestimates of what have been supplied to us. And I don't understand what the issue is with the manufacturers that from 1 week to the next, they can't give us more accurate estimates.
40 million doses of vaccine were promised by the end of October, but as of last Friday, only 16 million had been shipped. I asked Dr. Ann Schuchat what went wrong. She's chief of the immunization branch at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She says vaccine manufacturers use chicken eggs to grow the virus for the vaccine, and until recently, they didn't have the chemical they needed to run tests on the virus they were growing.
And then when they were run, the manufacturers basically found out that the product that they had was actually less than they thought they had.
On top of that, there were glitches in new machines they installed, machines that put vaccine in vials and put the vials in packages. Ann Schuchat says CDC officials didn't realize the effect of these problems until the middle of this month. Manufacturers say they're fixing the problems now, but the flu virus is roaring ahead. Vaccine production won't be able to catch up anytime soon. Schuchat says that raises an obvious question.
People wonder whether when vaccine is available for you or those in your family, will it be too late for that vaccine to give you any benefit?
It's hard to make an argument that the vaccine is going to protect very many people against this wave at the rate that it's coming out.
That's Mark Lipsitch of Harvard. He does a lot of work for the CDC trying to predict the course of swine flu.
Most of this wave will be over by the time most Americans have access to the vaccine.
Actually, Ann Schuchat disagrees. She says even when this wave of swine flu peaks, there'll still be time for many people to get vaccinated.
A key point is that even when peak occurs in any one area, half the people that are going to become infected haven't yet become infected.
L.A.'s Health Commissioner Jonathan Fielding thinks Schuchat is the one who's right.
I don't think it's too little too late. I think it's too little. And obviously for people who get sick or who get very seriously ill, it's too late. But for many others, I think it's going to arrive in time to help prevent disease.
One more opinion. As of last week, the head of the CDC says he's had it for now with making predictions about flu vaccine. Richard Knox, NPR News.
Now this question, in light of the delays in producing the swine flu vaccine, are there more efficient methods of production than what's currently in use? And what's currently in use depends heavily on some low-tech involuntary lab workers. That's right, the process of making the vaccine uses chickens to make eggs. It's actually very chicken-intensive. And there are some new methods in sight, but not quite in use here. Joining us to talk about this is Dr. Robert Belshi, who's director of the Center for Vaccine Development at St. Louis University. Welcome to the program, Dr. Belshi.
Good afternoon.
And first, tell us about the tried-and-true egg method.
Well, eggs turn out to be very, very susceptible to influenza. And it has to be a special egg. It has to be an embryonated egg. And a 10-day-old embryo is about the ideal culture medium for influenza. And so vaccine manufacturers use embryonated hen's eggs to produce large quantities of influenza virus, and then they purify from that the vaccine that we use on an annual basis to prevent influenza.
You say embryonized, fertilized, I guess, eggs. How many does it take to make a flu shot? How many does it take to make a nasal spray vaccine?
It takes about one egg to make one dose of the flu shot. It turns out that it's much more efficient to make the nasal spray vaccine. In fact, you can get hundreds of doses from one egg of the nasal spray vaccine.
And part of the process when the country orders up a batch of vaccine is you've got to get those roosters and hens to work.
That's right. These are not the ordinary eggs you buy in the grocery store, which are generally not fertilized, but it requires a fertilized hen's egg. So you've got to have a rooster and a hen get together, do their thing. Then the eggs have to be laid, and then they have to be incubated till about 10 days old for the ideal culture medium.
Well, that's the egg method. What are the alternatives that are out there?
Well, instead of growing virus in eggs, it's possible to grow influenza virus in tissue culture. So these are cells that are selected from organs that are grown up in large quantities. And then one can grow influenza in these living cells. One of the cell lines that is very good at growing influenza is a dog kidney cell line.
And would large numbers of dogs be sacrificed to make a batch of a flu vaccine?
No, you don't have to sacrifice the dog in order to make the tissue culture. This tissue culture has been in existence for many, many years, and the cells can be grown essentially forever in the laboratory, and so no animals need to be sacrificed.
And thinking beyond dog kidney tissue?
Well, there are a lot of other technologies being developed for making influenza vaccine. We can make proteins in the laboratory using recombinant DNA technology. And the leading technology today is an insect tissue culture system. So it's grown up in literally caterpillar cells and then produce lots and lots of protein that way.
Now, when you think of, say, caterpillar cells being used in that example, how many days or how much risk could you knock off the production of a quantity of flu vaccine compared to what we're doing now with the eggs?
With the egg, it takes about 2 months. Tissue cultures, whether it's dog kidney or caterpillar cells, can be grown up in a matter of a few days. And so you cut off a couple of months by going to these newer ways of manufacturing influenza vaccine.
Well, Dr. Belshi, thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
That's Dr. Robert Belshi, who is director of the Center for Vaccine Development at St. Louis University in Missouri.
That was Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered. And we finish up today with our second report about mental health problems on college campus. The number of students seeking psychiatric help is on the rise. That's true from small community colleges to elite universities. Last week, we told you about the problem. Today, NPR's Deborah Franklin tells us what some schools are doing about it.
A new crop of freshmen arrived on the Stanford University campus in California last month. It was a blue sky day as they stood in line outside the dorms waiting for room assignments from the student resident assistants.
Just got your name tag and all that jazz, PO box key, and this little packet.
Looking on, Stanford residence dean, Arcadio Morales. He and his family have an apartment in the dorms, and he's helped usher in every new class for 15 years. In a quieter moment, Morales told us that there have always been some students who pack emotional baggage along with their laptops and books, but the mix of problems he sees have changed.
Early on, most of the issues that surface were roommate issues, sort of compatibility issues.
He still gets that stuff, along with anxiety over midterms. But these days, Morales is seeing some more serious mental health issues, too.
We're getting students that wouldn't have been here 10 years ago because they're on antidepressants or antipsychotic medication, and they're functioning, you know, fairly well.
But it can be a big challenge for the colleges when these students have crises, which has been happening more often at Stanford and other schools. Those middle-of-the-night calls are very hard for any school and any student.
I was just going through a depression, but it was a depression that was getting worse and worse.
Amanda Gellander, now a Stanford senior, has bipolar disorder with symptoms that are mostly evened out with medication. But that night in the dorm 2 years ago, the bottom fell out, and she called a family member.
I was in hysterical tears. I was making remarks, you know, what's the point, you know, just things that a depressed person would say. Just very, I was really sad.
But not suicidal, she says. She just needed to vent. After that, Amanda hung up the phone and went to sleep. She had no idea her family was worried enough to call 911.
And about an hour later, there's banging on my door. I go to the door. There's two armed police who barge in, and they're talking about, you know, where are your pills? And they start ransacking through my entire room. They're opening drawers. They're going through my shelves. And I'm half naked. I'm dressed for bed. And, you know, they're like, are you going to kill yourself? Are you going to kill yourself? I'm just like, no, I'm not going to kill myself. And they're threatening to take me to the psych ward. And they've got their handcuffs in their hands. And I don't know what you say to convince someone that you're not going to kill yourself besides, no, I'm not going to kill myself.
The police phoned the psychiatrist on call, and after some back and forth, they left. But the whole experience left Amanda horribly shaken. She understands the police have been asked to deal with suicide threats this way. It's protocol. She doesn't blame her family. They just wanted to keep her safe.
But that's the option that loved ones have. If they fear for someone, they have to call the police.
Of course, figuring out on the spot who's a risk to themselves and who's not isn't easy for anyone. Stanford's Arcadio Morales helps train student residence assistants in the dorms.
And I always tell the RAs, better to have someone angry and alive than dead and dead.
Everyone agrees it's much better to get help for a troubled student before they're in crisis. All across the U.S., concerned colleges, students, and parents are trying to do just that. Amanda Gellander started a theater project to bring mental illness into the light. And down the street from Stanford, a former Palo Alto mayor and his wife, Vic and Mary Ojakian, became mental health advocates after their son, Adam, died by suicide at the University of California, Davis, in 2004.
We determined that he became very anxious due to a certain situation, what's called a triggering event, and it was ultimately severe depression that caused his death.
Mary Ojakian and her husband didn't know their son was depressed. He never talked about it. But after Adam died, they interviewed his friends, people in the counseling center, police, professors, even the chancellor. And that's when they learned about the shortage of therapists on college campuses and about how little training most faculty and even police get in how to recognize and handle mentally ill students.
We realized, and they realized, that there was a lot that could be done to change the situation on campus.
The whole situation just makes Vic Ojakian angry.
Guess what? What's going on right now isn't acceptable. We took a look at our situation and we said to ourselves, we don't want another good human being dying. And we decided to do something about that, not to sit back, not to do another study. We decided we were going to go save lives.
Yeah, someone's got to draw the line.
Someone else has drawn the line, or tried to. The International Association of Counseling Services recommends that in order to keep students safe and healthy, a college campus should have a minimum of one therapist for every 1,000 to 1,500 students. When you fall short of that, and many colleges do, the wait lists for students seeking help can get very, very long. And research shows that students who get stuck on these wait lists are more likely to drop out of school. Vic Ojakian.
When you have an illness, most of us want to be treated immediately. If you break your arm, you don't want somebody saying to you, you're going to have to wait 2 to 6 weeks.
But that's the sort of wait time Stanford students faced last year until the university hired 6 more therapists. At the same time, it introduced a new system to triage phone calls so that the neediest students could get in to see a counselor right away. The university hired psychiatrist Dr. Ron Albuquer to head the counseling center.
It was a pretty intense trial by fire when I first got here. There were quite a few things going on at the same time.
Psychiatric hospitalizations were up. So were the number of students who needed medication as well as therapy. And most students who want or need long-term counseling still have to be referred to therapists off campus.
Because even with that many counselors, we're still incredibly busy.
When Stanford's endowment took a big hit last year and the school had to slash its budget, it chose not to lay off therapists. It did add a new fee for all students, about $500 a year, with most of that money going to mental health services. Daniel Eisenberg is a mental health researcher at the University of Michigan. He says in these very tight financial times, some other universities and colleges are making tough choices.
College campuses see their central mission as being education, and so I think there's sometimes a question about whether mental health services really fits into that central mission.
Vic and Mary Ojakian, whose son died in the midst of a deep depression, think society doesn't have a choice. Some big fixes will cost big money, and they think it's a good investment given the statistics. Half of all cases of mental illness first show up in the early teen years, and 75% by age 24. Vic Ojakian says college is prime time to intervene and get these young adults on a healthy path. He also has ideas for high school seniors and their parents.
For parents, they need to look at a college not just in terms of its academic credentials. They need to make sure that the mental health service they provide on campus, they need to get an idea of what they're doing and how well they're doing it.
Asking about the number of counselors and what services they have for students after hours. That's just a start, he says. Some other mental health tools are just as important and cheap enough that even financially strapped colleges should have them in place.
How do they communicate their services? Because that's a critical thing. You know, how do they use their web, some of these social networking tools? Do campuses have peer support groups?
Amanda Gellander, who was so depressed 2 years ago, says support from friends, family, and her doctor, along with a change in her medication, were all crucial to helping her get back on track.
Now, every day's a struggle, but I have more hope. I'm applying to a lot of postgraduate programs. I'm actually excited about my future.
Bipolar disorder is still a part of her, Amanda says, but it doesn't define her. Deborah Franklin, NPR News.
And that's all for Your Health. Please join us again next week for the best from the health desk here at National Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Davis. Thanks for listening.